Call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development meeting to order, January 27th. Thanks for being here. We have an informational meeting today on ports, generally. And we're pleased to have some guests from Port Portland and the Port of St. Helens. So I'm happy to invite Dave Breen forward and hear from his presentation.
First of all, I wanted to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the port and our efforts to address air quality issues and greenhouse gas emissions. Before I start talking about those efforts, I think I'd like to start with a little primer of the port's operations to give you a little bit of background on
That'd be terrific. And may I also just ask you to repeat your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. David Breen, I'm the Air Quality Program Manager with the Port of Portland. The Port of Portland operates four marine terminals in the Portland area and operates the dredging equipment that maintains a navigational channel on the lower Columbia and Willamette Rivers. We also own and operate five industrial parks, industrial and corporate parks in the metropolitan area. Also, three airports, including Portland International Airport. Portland International Airport has about 14 million passengers that pass through the airport on an annual basis. But more than passengers, or just as much as passengers, cargo is a very important part of our aviation operations, with more than 230,000 tons of air cargo per year passing through PDX. PDX functions like a small city in that it provides more than 9,000 jobs in the metropolitan area. In addition to PDX, the port operates two regional airports, Troutdale and Hillsborough, which are very busy airports which cater to corporate travel, aircraft maintenance companies, and also training for flight and helicopter. The Columbia River is the largest wheat and grain export region in the United States. Barges deliver grain and other agricultural products from ports upstream located in Oregon and Idaho and take those products down to our marine terminals where grain and other products are offloaded onto large ships at Terminal 5. These are very economical transport means for farmers, and they're also very environmentally friendly. The fuel consumption by barges is substantially less than that of commercial vehicles, including large trucks. The Port of Portland's a little bit different from other ports on the West Coast that where container business is their primary business. Our largest commodities are mineral bulks, including potash and soda ash. We handle 5.5 million metric tons of minerals, 4.5 million metric tons of grains. We're the largest automobile port on the West Coast, handling about 500,000 automobiles. And then our Terminal 6 also handles about 160,000 containers a year. This slide, just to put it in perspective as far as the container business, This is not a map of the distribution areas, but this shows a relative order of magnitude of the container business on the West Coast, with Long Beach and Los Angeles collectively handling about 16 million what they call TEUs, or 20-foot equivalents. And by comparison, we handle about 250,000 TEUs.
And TEUs are the containers, right?
Is that that's correct, okay. Mr. Chair. That's TEU stands for 20-foot equivalent. So a 20-foot box is one TEU, a 40-foot box is two TEUs. We compete extensively with ports just to the north of us. Tacoma, Seattle, and Vancouver Metro each handle about 2 million TEUs. And a new port was just built, container port was built in British Columbia at Prince Rupert with an ultimate capacity of 2 million TEUs. Economically, the port provides not only extensive jobs in this area, but also accounts for substantial revenues, generating more than 30,000 jobs in the region. Altogether, more than 75,000 jobs are credited to the Port of Portland maritime and aviation facilities. So that's about one in every 14 jobs in the region, and that's about $3 billion in personal income. The port realizes that we walk with a large environmental footprint, and in 2000, the Port Commission adopted an environmental policy that challenges all port employees to integrate environmental considerations into our strategic planning and also business decision making. We've had an environmental management system in place since that time, and we've identified our significant aspects, environmental aspects and impacts, and on an annual basis, we set targets to address our significant environmental impacts. This year, we've decided that we are going to voluntarily report to the Climate Registry. The port first put in place an air emissions inventory for the baseline year of 2000, and that inventory included all the criteria air pollutants, but we also were one of the first ports to count CO2 in an air emissions inventory. So this year, we're taking it one step further and reporting for the first year that you can to the Climate Registry for 2008, and that will be for all operations that are owned and controlled by the port. The reason that we decided to report voluntarily is to identify and manage our greenhouse gas risks and opportunities, utilize a consistent and widely used methodology for greenhouse gas reporting. The Climate Registry has been adopted by all but 11 states. It's the registry that's going to be utilized by the Western Climate Initiative. And we're also wanting to report to document early actions to our voluntary measures. Although we haven't completed our emission inventory under the Climate Registry, we do have a pretty good idea of where our greenhouse gas emissions primarily occur, and they're predominantly associated with indirect emissions from our facility heating and lighting. And beyond that, the second largest source is from our boilers, which are used to provide steam out at PDX. And those are clean burning boilers. They run on natural gas. So probably not a lot of opportunity to do much with the boilers. And then from there, the port operates some fleet vehicles, including the cargo handling equipment out at our Marine Terminal 6, and also our dredge equipment, which maintains the navigational channels. The port has been working extensively with tenants and some of our transportation partners to look for ways to reduce our energy consumption and emissions from our mobile emission sources. With respect to energy, the power we purchase, we are increasing the proportion which is produced from renewable sources. And with respect to mobile emissions, when it comes to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, one of the most undisputed tactics for reducing greenhouse gas emissions is to reduce idling of operating mobile emission equipment. Throughout our marine and aviation facilities, we have undertaken installing efficient lighting fixtures with automatic shutoff devices, and daylighting is being maximized in our new development. Last year, we did a project focused on four maintenance buildings, and we cut greenhouse gas emissions by 371 tons, which is equivalent of removing 62 vehicles off the road each year. We're currently purchasing 10% of our energy from renewable sources with an ultimate goal of purchasing 100% renewable energy. Our initial purchase of 10% was equivalent of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 2,000 tons. Alternative fuel vehicles and alternative fuels is an important part of our strategy. This graph shows a comparison of conventional diesel fuel with other fuels and their greenhouse gas emissions relative to its energy content. So compressed natural gas is a substantial reduction. All of our vehicles, our fleet out at PDX is all powered on compressed natural gas. So to go around some of our facilities and some of the projects that we've implemented, first at our Terminal 2, which is a break bulk facility. We also have an area of the facility that the Army Corps of Engineers used to dock their two of their dredge vessels. So we've just installed cold ironing at Terminal 2 so that the Army Corps of Engineers, when they dock their dredging vessels, can completely shut the engines off. And they can plug into 400, 800 amp electrical power at the terminal. And we also have a natural gas fired boiler so that the ship's boilers don't have to operate. At Terminal 5, there's at Portland Bulk Terminals, they handle potash export, and they use switching locomotives to push the unit trains through the rotary dumper pits. So they replaced four of their existing locomotives. They've replaced two of them with what are called traction slugs, so there's no engines on it. They use the electricity that's generated from two of the engines to power the motors on the axles. It cuts the fuel consumption 30% annually and has a substantial reduction in greenhouse gas emissions as well. When these locomotives are not being used, they're parked on a lead track, and they have electrical pedestals that they plug into at night to keep the locomotive fluid warm so that there's no idling when they're not in use. At our Marine Terminal 6, we use propane and compressed natural gas to power some of the vans for the labor vans and also some of our maintenance vehicles. We recently installed a $2 million computerized system with an optical character reader, which substantially reduces idling. This reader basically takes all the information off of the truck, the chassis, the box number, and can process up to three trucks a minute, substantially reducing the idling across the terminal. And we're currently in the process of building another cold ironing facility for Shaver Transportation, who provides tug services on the Columbia and Willamette. So they will be able to plug their tugs in when they're not in use at our Terminal 6 facility. If any of you have been out to Portland or flown out of Portland International Airport recently and have been in the short-term parking, you've seen the colored lights that show you where there's available parking spaces. In addition, we have a fast pay, and both of those have substantially used idling from passenger vehicles that visit the terminals. As I mentioned earlier, we've also replaced our entire diesel fleet of shuttle buses with buses that operate on compressed natural gas. We entered into a joint project at PDX with Nike and Northwest Airlines to install a array of solar panels, which provides lighting for 75% of the electricity used by Nike at the airport. Currently, the port is building a new headquarters out at PDX, and the headquarters is scheduled to be open in 2010. And there's a number of measures that have been designed into the building aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. One is using ground source heating and cooling, or geothermal source for heating the building. There's extensive daylighting to minimize the use of lighting at the facility. We're currently looking at installing electric hybrid plug-ins for future vehicle use at our headquarters. We're going to have a on-site wastewater treatment facility, which is a very clean process, doesn't produce much methane. And we're also looking at adding additional solar electricity capacity at the airport, including installing an array of 0.2 megawatts worth of solar panels on the parking garage. And we're also looking at other areas of the airport. One thing that airports have is quite a bit of land, and so there's areas that we're looking at for putting solar panels. And, for example, 2 megawatts solar would be the equivalent of reducing electricity from 170 homes or taking 235 passenger cars off the road. There's a lot more information on the projects that we've initiated that are on our website, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher, please.
Thanks. Going back, I guess kind of had a question. When you showed the map where you looked at containers served by different ports along the West Coast, why would Portland be so small compared to the pretty much everybody else?
There's a lot of dynamics involved in transportation logistics. L.A. and Long Beach have an advantage with a population base of 20 million people, for one thing. They've also have good infrastructure as far as rail access out the Cajon Pass. One issue that hampers us a bit is the depth of the Columbia River. At that depth that is currently maintained, which I believe is about 45 feet, it limits the size of ships that can come up the river to about 6,500 TEUs. And over the last 10 years, ships have progressively been built bigger and bigger, where, you know, 10, 15 years ago, 4,000 TEU ship was a standard size. Now many ships are 10,000 TEUs, and now they're even building 13,000 TEU ships. So those ships will never make it into the Portland area. We also compete extensively with Tacoma and Seattle, and those ports are also have a larger metropolitan base, and they also, because more of a desire for shippers to come into that region, are able to enter into long-term agreements on their terminals where the port doesn't have that advantage. So a shipper can come in or leave our facilities with very little notice. So channel depth is probably one of the biggest issues, but the dynamics also, they involve a lot of factors involving costs, labor costs, due to environmental concerns. In the last couple of years, they've seen a overall shift to the Gulf Coast and the East Coast. The West Coast, and this is before the current economic issues had really come in into play, but in 2007-2006, the West Coast collectively lost 4% of container business. The Gulf Coast gained about 12%, and the East Coast about 9%. So there's a lot of dynamics involved in that, and there's also additional things that will come into play, like the work currently being done on the Panama Canal to widen the locks will allow bigger ships to be able to pass through. So the Port of Portland staff works very aggressively to attract and retain shipping lines, and it's sometimes a little bit of a challenge.
A follow-up on the didn't we have some sort of dredging project going on? Is that not happening?
Yes, it is currently.
It is, okay. But I do have a question about greenhouse gases, if that's okay. You were talking about a pie chart indicating where greenhouse gases are come from mostly, you say indirectly from electricity use, like lighting, and would that also be plug-ins for ships and hybrids and things like that?
That chart is for sources that are owned or operated by the port and doesn't include emissions from large ocean-going vessels or locomotives, for example. In addition to the measures that we take, we join with other ports in supporting measures that will happen on an international level, for example, through the International Maritime Organization, where they're developing standards to switch from heavier bunker fuels to light distillates, which are much cleaner burning.
And I guess I wasn't. I was talking about how we stop them from idling now by plugging them in. Would this impact this chart? You know, where usage, if you're going to be increasing your electrical use by plug-ins, I'm wondering how that would change this picture here on this pie chart.
Oh, I understand. Well, it'll increase the electrical use, absolutely, for plug-ins, although we will likely set up separate metering for the Army Corps of Engineers and also for Shaver Transportation. In some cases, like at a PDX, everything is off of one common meter that the port pays, so there's some areas that it's a little bit hard to separate. But as you move to more electrification, it'll cause that piece of the pie to increase.
But it would also be fair to say that as the share increases, the total greenhouse gas emissions would still come down.
Yes.
If you include the pieces not owned by the port.
For the pieces not owned by the port?
As total greenhouse gas emissions will come down, even as the share represented by electricity in this graph goes up.
Right, and there's a lot to consider in that, too, like the source of electrical power, how much is generated by coal. Coal puts off more greenhouse gases than oil combustion, for example. So there's a lot that has to factor into that look.
Of course. Did you have any further thoughts?
Well, I was curious about the geothermal. Where are we going to get that? I didn't know we had geothermal up there, but I don't want to monopolize the committee.
Why don't you continue with that conversation? I know Representative Gilliam had a question too, but could you comment on the geothermal, please?
I'm not the project manager for the project, but we are able to tap into geothermal source near the headquarters and provide to the headquarters building.
Okay.
Great. Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few quick curious points here. I missed a few part of the first few slides, so I apologize. Did you say how many employees and where are you guys? I'm sure you have many offices, but where are you headquartered? I'm not aware of where you guys are.
The current headquarters is in downtown Portland, and it will be moving out to the airport. As far as port employees, we have about 650 port employees, but there's many jobs that are not port jobs, like ILWU, for example, that works the terminals. And I believe I had a number here for the... There's
looks like
about 30,000 jobs in the region that are associated with our marine and aviation facilities.
And then I'm just curious about, Mr. Chair, if I can do
please.
One more. You know, I know Nike's headquartered here, of course. It's a large shoe and apparel company.
I think I've heard of it.
And I just was curious why they're a partner. What is the volume they're doing at the airport that they jump in on a solar project like that?
Their share of electricity? I don't know what piece of the pie that is for the overall electricity consumption.
Their shipping product, is that it? Or the product is made elsewhere.
It is, you're right. And a fair number of samples come to the headquarters so we can figure out exactly what's going to be made.
So they got a high volume of stuff coming in.
Well, yeah, and this is for the store out at PDX, the retail store that operates out of the terminal.
Which would be in addition to the other operations, obviously.
And then my last question is, if I can, because she got, I mean, like
please.
Four.
You can. wide-ranging conversation here. Yeah.
I'm just curious, you've got, and you don't report to the government relations area, probably. You're in a whole different...
I work in the environmental group, but I'm sorry.
You come all the way down here. I'm just so surprised not to see former Vice Governor Imeson. And I'd just like you to take that back, that I'm very disappointed that he wasn't here for your presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No problem. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. The first one has to do with the data that you keep on what comes through the port. It's interesting to see all this hard work to reduce emissions, yet at the same time facilitating the importation of all kinds of stuff that might be just the opposite. So I'm just curious, wouldn't be your job to run off those herds of cars that come in that aren't necessarily environmentally positive. That wouldn't be a port's job. But you would be making lists of that kind of stuff. So there must be all kinds of data. Is it available on your webpage? Is that how we find out what comes into our state?
We keep an extensive air emissions inventory for all of our operations, and we share that with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality to make certain that our emissions data meshes up with their state implementation plan. Currently, we don't have the air emissions inventory posted on the website, though, but that information would be available, and we might look at providing on the website in the future.
Follow up, please. I was actually focusing more on what it is what's coming through the port in the form of imports, like cars, the number of them that come through, shoes for Nike, stuff like that. That would be interesting to me. Is that also on your website? What actually comes through the port?
Mm-hmm.
Comes in the door?
On the port's website, there are statistics for both marine and aviations, and it will tell how many containers are coming through the port facilities, for example, or how many tons of minerals, how many automobiles, but there won't be detail about what is it, the contents of the containers.
Are there general categories that say durable or consumer goods or...
If the port may have those statistics, but it's not on the website that I'm aware of.
One final follow-up. And thinking along that same line about what's in the containers, sustainability would suggest that there'd be some sort of method of making sure there isn't a bomb or some other awful thing in some of those containers. The port must have a pretty advanced security system. Is that a correct thought?
Yes, that is correct. And not being an expert in security, they do have a system in place that can detect radioactivity in the contents of a container. And they scan so many boxes, and I don't know how many, what the percentage is or how they pick what boxes that they scan. But in addition to that, we have the security system for transportation workers goes into effect in February. So without this transportation worker ID card, you can't get on any terminal. And all the terminal now has fencing around the perimeters. So the terminal security has increased substantially over the last year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Breen, thank you for your presentation. I'm kind of curious that just from watching your slides and listening to you, it seems that the Port of Portland has made some huge investments in trying to mitigate the greenhouse gases. And I'm just wondering what if you have a figure for us of how much greenhouse gases do you reduce per the dollar spent?
I don't have a figure available, but when we consider projects, that's always what goes into the evaluation, is what is the ton of greenhouse gas reduced for the dollar. And renewable electricity is by far the best method towards the biggest gains for the least amount of money, without question.
Would you include conservation in that calculation?
Well, conservation, yes, absolutely.
He answered my second question in his first answer.
Okay.
I was leading towards what was the most cost-effective method of reducing the greenhouse gases per dollar, and so you basically answered that already.
Congratulations, you anticipated his question.
Of course. Yeah, I feel like I've been cheated.
You could ask another question. You need to. The others have set a high bar.
I'll pass you some. Just kidding.
Well, I was interested. You talked about some of the challenges and disadvantages that the board has relative to other ports on the West Coast. Are there places that the Port of Portland has advantages?
I think the Columbia River is a advantage as far as barge traffic, although primarily so far as far as the bulk agricultural products. In 2004, several of the container lines departed the port for the Port of Tacoma, both Hyundai and K-Line, and they, especially with the current economy, are aggressively marketing containers that come out of Boardman Tri-Cities area, and so rather than coming down the Columbia River in very efficient and environmentally friendly means, they're going by truck up to the Port of Tacoma, and I think that's one thing too, is that if container business, for example, shifts up to Puget Sound, then one thing that has to be considered is that a lot of those containers are going to be delivered to the Portland area by much less efficient means, by truck. So those type of shifts can also have environmental consequences as well.
And is that largely a function of the depth of the river then, that they're choosing to go to Tacoma? Or what causes that?
Again, it's a number of issues. Tacoma is a deep water port. They have their berths are more than 50 feet deep. They don't have the ongoing maintenance issues that the Port of Portland does. They enter into long-term or minimum annual guarantees as part of their agreements, which guarantees the port a minimum volume of containers. So, for example, right now when things are contracting, for example, if they're dropping below their minimum annual guarantee, they're still going to pay the Port of Tacoma at least that amount of money. So if they have to make it up, they might then look at the Port of Portland and decide to pull containers up north. So, again, there's a lot of dynamics involved, rail rates, rail access. Although a lot of the unit trains, the double-stack trains you'll see coming through the Portland area, are actually out of the ports of Tacoma and Seattle. Because of Stevens Pass and the limitations, they have to clear the diesel emissions out of the tunnel before a following train can come through, and a single-line track through that extensive tunnel. It's very easy, especially during winter conditions, to move the rail traffic to the south and take it through Portland.
Representative Pauley?
One more question. I've always been interested in the Port of Portland and being so far up the Columbia. Have they ever thought about expanding to the suburbs a little bit closer to the mouth of the Columbia? Or is the transportation cost of getting the goods from the mouth, you know, into Portland, is cheaper to bring those container ships upstream?
This is definitely outside my area of expertise, but I believe that it would be an issue of the supporting infrastructure as far as rail access, for example. Quite a few unit trains carrying grain and mineral products service the terminals. I think that might be one of the biggest issues as far as opening a terminal closer to the mouth. So, but again, I'm the furthest from the expert in that area.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you know in your negotiations with other ports if there's a device that or a means of determining which port is the most efficient when it comes to environmental issues? In other words, is there a factor you add to each opportunity that takes into account the environmental cost? So you say it might be far better, all things considered, to unload the cars in San Francisco because by the time you get where they're going, it's far less CO2 generating. Is there an activity like that already going on?
There's certain third parties that have looked at various greenhouse gas emission scenarios. For example, taking containers to the Southern California ports and then using, which is frequently what happens, trains as an overland bridge to take the containers to the East Coast or areas in the Midwest versus taking them through the Panama Canal. And I know that maybe to some folks' surprise, it was actually lower greenhouse gas emissions by taking it to the West Coast and offloading it or transloading it onto trains. I think there's generally an unspoken agreement that ports will not use environmental issues to try and create a competitive advantage. But there is, for example, the Northwest ports have one distinct advantage in that they're closer markets to Asia. For large ships to come into this area to Puget Sound is a couple days shorter transit time than it is to make that same trip to Southern California. So there is an advantage there as well. But the most efficient means per ton of cargo are large ships, followed by barges, followed by rail, and then truck, although the truck plays a very important distribution component locally.
One follow-up, please. But I'm just curious, those studies and those and that data and those figures are available? That thinking is going on someplace? Where is that?
Some of that material is currently being developed. I know that the one study I was referring to, it was underway by a professor at University of Southern California, and his initial findings were discussed in the World Ports Climate Initiative meeting in Los Angeles in late November. So probably that study, for example, is forthcoming. But there's a number of studies on various means of reducing emissions, and there's toolboxes that are put out by the International Association of Ports and Harbors. American Association of Ports Authorities website has information on various projects for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and look at the cost feasibility of the various projects. And the ports work collaboratively and share that information. We're a member of the AAPA and other groups, and there are sub working groups like the Air Quality Working Group, which we meet at the various ports probably two or three times a year.
Thank you.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there measures that the port could take that would increase competitiveness for the port while at the same time improving the carbon footprint of the port. I'm thinking perhaps of investments in more efficient transportation between ships and warehousing facilities, or better rail integration, or those sorts of things that are out there on the table.
I think infrastructure investments is probably one of the biggest things as far as those type of local distribution systems and maintaining rail networks in Oregon and the metropolitan area, so that we do and can be competitive on goods movement locally, so that there's not any additional or an incentive to take that up north and then again bring it down through less efficient transport modes. So I think that is probably one of the biggest issues.
I was struck by your comment a moment ago about the presence of an unspoken agreement among ports not to use sustainability efforts and greenhouse gas reduction efforts as a mode of competition. Has that always been the case? Do you think that's changing? Will it change? And why is it?
Well, you'll always see marketing as green port, and I think that's pretty common, but I don't know if that'll change over time, but we've decided all ports are really decided to compete on the business issues and not environmental issues.
Could you also say though that those efficiencies and could end up reducing costs too that get passed on to those who use the port?
Yeah, absolutely. Where efficiencies can be built in. Like with rail networks, for example, there are certainly opportunities for efficiencies. And I think that there's also areas that there really needs to be an international or national approach to addressing issues, again, like emissions from large ocean-going vessels. For example, I know the question of coal ironing comes up, and there's a lot of specifics involved in coal ironing. It is by far not a one-size-fits-all issue. There's only certain types of ships that, when you talk about cost-effectiveness from the studies that have been done, that consume a high enough level of electricity while they're at berth that would warrant coal ironing.
And that's just where it's plugged into an external power source. I'm sorry, I don't totally know that
sorry.
That term. I'm trying to pick it up from context, but
yes, coal ironing is when a ship is brought to the into the berth with the tugs, and then it's docked there. They still need to maintain their power to operate their systems, onboard systems, while the ship is offloading its cargo, and so. A large ship typically has three engines. It's got one very large propulsion engine, and then it's got two smaller auxiliary engines. And when the ship is at berth, typically, well, the large propulsion engine is shut down, and the smaller auxiliary engines are providing that electrical power for the ship. So coal ironing is where they bring the electrical infrastructure onto the berth, and they shut down the auxiliary engines. It's a very costly proposition. It's about $3 to $10 million per berth for the infrastructure, and then for the ship, it's about $2 to $5 million per ship to install. And there's not a uniform standard for the type of plug-ins. So you may go to one port, and they have a type of plugs that they need, but not at other ports. And at the Port of Portland, I think some unique issues are that we don't have these long-term lease agreements. So if coal ironing was going to be looked at, for example, and it was not being considered at Tacoma or ports to the north, and we have, you know, the shipper was faced with paying $2 million per ship to retrofit and not having to do so to the north, and I mean, you could imagine what some of the decisions might be. Also, when you look at the type of our service, our ships are smaller. We don't have a lot of large container ships, and when they come to the Port of Portland, unlike Southern California, the time spent hoteling or at berth is generally a lot shorter. They don't come into Portland and offload all the containers and then put on a or fully load the ship. Typically, when they come to Portland, they only take a certain number of the containers off of the ship and add ones to the ship. So it's operating on a rotation with other West Coast ports. And at the car stop, they don't fully unload or offload the ship. So that means the time spent at berth is usually much shorter than what you'll see at, like, Los Angeles or to the north of us.
Representative Lee,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clarification, you said there's an agreement to compete on business issues, not environmental issues, and I'm curious, an agreement between whom? And
what do you mean?
Could you clarify the distinction that you see between business issues and environmental issues?
When I say agreement, there's not a written agreement. It's just that the ports, you know, are trying to work collaboratively or are working collaboratively on resolving environmental issues and trying to do so that one port doesn't create an economic advantage or disadvantage in the process. So, you know, when we compete, it's on supply chain logistics issues and the costs associated with that. And for example, not associated with the cost of differences associated, for example, in reducing emissions or handling ballast water or things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you for giving me another chance, Mr. Chair. I was hoping this would be answered amongst the other questions being asked, but I kept hearing you mention long-term agreements and how Seattle, Tacoma, they get the long-term agreements, and I guess I'm not real clear as to why Portland cannot get these or does not get these long-term agreements.
Well, keep in mind that these are business issues being answered by an environmental manager, but I will do my best to try and address them.
Okay.
I think it's due to maybe uncertainties in servicing the Portland market. We've had some lines that have come in and tried to provide services to Portland, and in some cases it worked out extremely well. In some cases they decided to try or make changes in their service. It's a very dynamic business and ever-changing, and you know, as the current economics, you know, change things, you know, it changes a lot of the factors that add up to the overall outlook for them. So I don't know if there's an easy answer to that, but, you know, certainly market size, local market size is probably one factor. But that might be better for our business folks.
Looks like we might have another perspective. Annette?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Annette Price. I'm the State of Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland. Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, to answer your question. Basically, the contracts that the Port of Portland has traditionally have been shorter term in nature given the market, based on market. But what I'd like to do, if possible, is to schedule an appointment with you and go through that in more detail as to what's going on.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Gilliam? She had another question?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll move forward then to the Port of St. Helens and get another perspective, if that's okay. And if you don't have to rush off somewhere, perhaps you could stick around in the room. It might generate some further questions, at least the contrast between larger and smaller ports.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much. So I invite Gerald Meyer forward, and anyone that you'd like to bring with you would be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the record, I'm Jerry Meyer, Executive Director, Port of St. Helens, 100 East Street, Columbia City, Oregon, 97018. 2 weeks ago, President Obama's stimulus speech, he specifically asked for money to modernize 75% of the federal buildings to meet the new energy efficiency standards, money to construct new smart energy grid, and initiatives to develop less expensive and more efficient solar panels, along with a wide variety of other new green energy technologies. More specifically, he promised that 10% of our energy will come from renewable sources by the end of his first term, and that's more than double its present share. Second, in 10 years, we will produce enough renewable energy to replace all the oil we import from the Middle East and Venezuela. And that would be as a result of investing around $150 billion each year for those 10 years. Very ambitious goals. And how does the president plan to attain these, one might ask? Where will the money go? Well, specifically by seeing to it that the United States has 1,150 mile per gallon plug-in hybrid cars within the next 6 years, and that we double the amount of electrical energy produced from solar and wind, and also that we would produce 2 billion gallons of affordable biofuels and new buildings to meet 50% more energy-efficient standards. So the big winners in this monetary subsidy field would include third-generation biofuels, reducing the cost of solar energy, wind power storage and transmission, and motor vehicle efficiencies to meet current or higher than current efficiency standards. Well, you know, how does this apply to the little port of St. Helens, you might ask, and I guess I'd like to give you a little background on the Port of St. Helens. First of all, we consist in Columbia County, 61 miles long along the Columbia River, 5 miles inland. We have access to about 2,000 acres. Most of it we own. Some of it we have optioned for developed and undeveloped projects. We own and operate the Scappoose Industrial Air Park. And we also have some a few recreational properties, the Scappoose Bay Marina being one of our largest. Today, however, I'd like to focus on Port Westward, which is our most northern property by the city of Clatskanie. We own about 850 acres out at Port Westward, which PGE leases from us. We have an option on 1,100 more acres out there. And currently, the current tenants are PGE with their Beaver plant, which is a 530-megawatt generation plant, gas-fired. They just opened about a year and a half ago their second plant, which is a 400-megawatt Port Westward generation plant. And then, of course, Cascade Grains ethanol facility, where they produce are supposed to produce about 100 million gallons of ethanol per year. Additionally, PGE just recently went out with an RFP for 200 more megawatts of power, so that's supposed to come online in the year 2011, and we're anxious to see that coming. So all in total, there's about $500 million worth of tenant investment out there and about 160 well-paying jobs. So we're proud of that fact. What does this all mean for the Port of St. Helens? Well, we've positioned ourselves over the last 10 years to build infrastructure out at Port Westward, and we feel that the president's incentives are timely for the Port of St. Helens. Again, we've optioned about 1,100 acres of property alongside a tree farm where growers can significantly reduce the impacts on the environment, where trees and industry can exist side by side and even complement each other. We have some industry that's interested in using some of the forest debris from these tree farms for their business. We've also secured 124 acres adjacent to Port Westward that is fully served, and has incentives already in place, which makes it a very attractive piece of property for future energy-related businesses. So why do we need to do this? Well, it's no secret that Columbia County has been known for many years for its vast resources and the forestry industry. And that industry is struggling. So I'm sure you've all heard that Boise Cascade just laid off 300 folks, which is a big hit to our community. So the Port of St. Helens is looking for different alternatives to sustain our local struggling economy. We're looking for different ways and different businesses that can come in there and give us a long, sustained relationship and good-paying jobs for the long term. Some of the companies that we've been talking to, and without mentioning specific names, I could attach probably one or two companies to each one of these folks. We've been talking to some biomass folks. Biomass extracts sugars from cellulose to produce ethanol and other types of fuels, and they use agriculture and forest residue products and even fast-growing trees and grasses. Those projects typically are around $300 million. Biodiesel, it's traditional. You've seen it across the country, usually using soybean oil, palm oil, canola oils, the food-grade oils. They mix it with alcohol, and they produce biodiesel. Hard to get those contracts, long-term contracts for that product, but nonetheless, they're still looking at that technology. $160 million is about what it would take to build one of those facilities, according to the person we're talking to. Synthetic diesel, this is one that has a great deal of interest for the Port of St. Helens. Synthetic diesel fabricated from natural and man-made resources. So they can actually take garbage, they can take tires, they can take roofing products and combine it with some agricultural products and create a syngas, and then in turn produce, put it through a Fischer-Tropsch system and make biodiesel out of it. So we're very interested in that technology. It also comes oftentimes with cogeneration plants. So there is a portion of electricity that's generated out of that can sustain the process. So interesting technology, and that's about a $400 million project. I mentioned the Cascade Grain Project. That's traditional corn ethanol. That was about $182 million plant. It's up and going, and like I said, they're expected to produce about 100 million gallons of ethanol this year. We've also talked to advanced corn ethanol folks. They use a process called front-end fractionization, where they take the corn kernel and they'll split it up into four different parts, and they use it for different areas in their technology. The bottom line is it makes it more efficient. You get a food-grade source out of it. You get feed for chickens and cows, and you also get corn oil. So $300 million project if that were to go forward. Solar, if you would have talked to me a year ago about solar out of Columbia County, I would have said you were nuts. But these guys have come to us and are going through the studies and convince us that solar is definitely possible out of Columbia County. So what they need is an area free of shade, and we've got plenty of that. The idea is we're thinking about maybe even doing this in our tree farm area. So I guess today we would be removing snow from the panels, but other than that, it's been very successfully used in Germany. So it's certainly something that we're interested in. These folks are possibly talking about doing 10 to 20 megawatts out at Port Westward at a cost of between $40 and $80 million. And then gasified coal is another company. Port Westward Energy has proposed doing IGCC where you would actually take coal and gasify it and make a biodiesel or energy out of it. So I'm sure you're all aware cap and trade is needed for this technology to go forward. They're trying to make this happen right now in Texas, so we're just kind of waiting to see if that technology is going to come to fruition. And then our friends at Port of Portland also mentioned geothermal, and there's even some wind possibilities out in Columbia County. So we're looking at all those things. Geothermal just requires hot rocks in the ground, and if you go deep enough, oftentimes you can find them. So then you can spin a generator off that with the steam. So that's kind of how that works. How are we going to do this? Well, we've already started and have been at it for some time now, last 10 years. We do it through partnerships with our service providers, the PUD. PUD out there has some of the cheapest power in the nation, third cheapest. They're a great partner. P&W Railroad. We've partnered with our railroad constituency to upgrade the infrastructure, local agencies, the city, the county, and even third-party investors is how we're making this work. Currently, with the infrastructure, the rail, we've just, through Connect Oregon 1 and 2 and OECDD loans, we've built more than $6 million of new rail infrastructure out at Port Westward, and with another $1 million coming for a Y project. We've got a great water system out there. We've spent $8.5 million on a rainy well that collects water from underneath the Columbia River. And, of course, along with that is a 30 CFS water right. So we have the full distribution and discharge system and NPDES permit that we're in the process of finding ways to come up with temperature mitigation so we can find tributaries out in Columbia County and shade those with trees and vegetation so we can counteract warmer water that goes back into the river from our industry. We own a dock system out there, 1,200-foot lineal dock. It's a great place. It's situated in a great place on the river. It's actually self-scouring where our dock is in that part of the channel. So we actually have a 70-foot channel depth there that we never have to dredge. So we've got a lot of things going for us with our site. We've got, again, the water access, the rail, and the road. Incentives. Back in early 2000, I believe, it was the county and the port that worked together to create the Urban Renewal District, which focuses primarily on revitalization of business in the area by focusing on infrastructure-ready projects. And that doesn't affect the local community. The businesses pay for those taxes directly. Other incentives, the port's been has experienced a great deal of interest from out-of-state business because of the Betsy credits, which have helped us a great deal. The biofuels use tax credit and energy trust program. The port has been trying to take full advantage of these and other federal tax exemption opportunities offered for energy businesses. Likewise, we created an enterprise zone. In addition to the federal and state taxes, we also joined Columbia County to create the Lower Columbia Enterprise Zone. And that was to create additional benefits for businesses willing to locate within the area. It's dependent upon employees and salaries and all that. And then lastly, we have a unique ability to do non-recourse bond financing. So when these companies come to us in these tough economic times, we can offer financing. We feel like we're sitting in a very good position right now to get some of these companies because of that. A lot of folks don't realize that we financed Trojan back in the 70s, so we have the ability to do that. So that concludes my presentation. I was interested in hearing from the Port of Portland that they're wanting to buy 100% green power, and we're certainly happy to sell that to them. So when they're ready to do that, they should come look us up. And I also wanted to thank Representative Witt for all of his hard work and dedication. I think without that, we wouldn't be successful out at Port Westward. So thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
We're glad he's on our committee as well.
So if anybody has any questions, hopefully I can answer them.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a little confused on clarification here. Is the urban renewal area and the enterprise zone, do those overlap?
Yes, they do.
Has it worked to have an enterprise zone where you have tax abatement in an area where you need to generate an increment to pay back the bonds in the urban renewal area?
So far, it's worked fine. I mean, we don't have, Cascade Grain is the first company that's really taken advantage of that, but we haven't seen any problem with it. And I think the county just recently expanded the enterprise zone, if I'm remembering right. So we're hoping that we can use that to attract new businesses.
How would you characterize the sorts of things you're looking at with the bonding authority that you have? Are there particular areas? I mean, you talked about a lot of opportunities that are in front of you. Have you matched some of those up with bonds, or what you're thinking?
You know, it takes what we're finding is for these large projects, it takes an incredible amount of due diligence before you're ready to actually go and put it in front of bond council. A couple of those projects were close. So I think probably next month we will be taking a trip back to New York to see, you know, how that might work. With the economy the way it is, it's just money is just not flowing yet. So I think everybody's just positioning themselves right now for when this big gate of the million or the billions of dollars is supposed to open up. Nobody really is understanding how we're going to get that money, but we're posturing for it. So I'm hoping and I'm hearing that there is private money out there still, and we're anxious to test it to see if we can get one of these projects moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We encountered the same difficulty on a cogen project or a it was actually sugar beets they wanted to slice in Nissa, and they had everything ready to go, and then boom. So can you identify for us exactly where it is in the process that the money isn't? Can you tell us? Because I know I listened to them, and they seemed to they brought someone out from New York and told us all about it, and I'm just curious if you could identify exactly where you see the frozen stream of money.
Yeah, thank you. I believe that the due diligence, as I mentioned, has changed. So 2 years ago, and hopefully I answer your question, 2 years ago, all these finance folks were looking for was they were looking for a AAA rating or you know, that you were creditworthy and you were good to go. Now they're starting to look at all the different factions. They're looking at who it is you're dealing with. They're looking at the technologies. Have the technologies been proven? Have they worked together in the past? Can you get the feedstock? Can you get long-term feedstock agreements? So all of these things we're told have to be put into place. We're working with a company, an underwriter, that just did the Arrow Rock project. And so, you know, that's a good thing. They just bonded $41 million for that hydro facility. So we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, I'm optimistic that it'll break loose, but I guess until we ask the question and make these guys feel comfortable with the technology, I'd be happy to come back and let you know how that works. I do feel that we probably should be staying away from food sources, and technologies are changing so rapidly that's really where this technology is going. These plants that we talk to, they can start out with, say, for example, palm oil, but they can move into other areas like, you know, garbage, or, you know, they're that diverse now. So it'll be interesting to see what happens within the next year and a half.
I wouldn't want to ask you to speak for all the other
ports, but it sort of strikes me that there's a fairly big difference between some of the things we heard from the Port of Portland as a fairly large port and you as a somewhat smaller port. Would you be comfortable talking generally about how your port compares to some of the other small ports in the area?
You know, ports are very different animals. We're the same, but we're very different. You know, our port is mostly, you know, we're land development. That's what we do. We don't have container ships, and we don't have a large airport. So I don't really compete with the Port of Portland, with the exception of bringing in those certain industries. And then even then, it's more based on property that we have available. So I used to work for the Port of Portland, and I did a lot of development out at Rivergate and Swan Island, and I know that you know, a lot of their property is used up, and they've got some very great, you know, businesses there. So they're self-sustaining and kind of just a different animal than the Port of St. Helens. And then you've got the ports along the coast, which are, they're more recreational ports, so they have fishing industry, and they have more of a recreational flair to their name. So we all try to work together. If there's a way, you know, recently we had a building collapse at our port, and I called one of our neighboring ports and said, hey, if you can house my tenant, that would be great. We want to keep them local. We want to keep them in this area. We want to keep those jobs. So that's what our goal is to keep jobs and sustainable business.
Yeah. Just checking to see if anyone had any questions. You're talking about the ways that big and small ports can cooperate. Are there things that we should be doing and considering in the legislature that are serving as, you know, obstacles for other things that you want to be doing now, recognizing the economic environment we're in? And I suspect all of us here have ideas about places we think would be good investments of dollars, but that's less and less likely these days. Are there other things that ports would be eager to see?
Well, I think, you know, for us, of course, we need the incentives for these businesses to come here. You know, the Betsy credit I mentioned is I think it's up to 50% now, and that's great. I mean, we need that, and I think that helps all the ports. Any kind of incentives like that can get business in certainly helps. The environmental side of the house, DEQ, NPDES permits, I know that those things are hard to come by, but we're going to need them. You know, we will need more discharge into the river, and there's a responsible way to do that. You can treat water. You can do it all kinds of different ways. We're frankly having a hard time identifying or satisfying the requirements of the permit to get that done. We'd love to do it. The tenants are anxious to find a river or a stream that they can do their mitigation on, but you know, it's just cutting through some of that red tape that sometimes becomes the stickler on that. So I think you guys are doing a great job. You've certainly helped us a tremendous amount out at Port Westward. The state has been very helpful in you know, getting us loans. That's the other thing. I mean, I can't speak for the Port of Portland, but for the smaller ports, infrastructure is a huge issue for us. So, you know, we just don't have a great deal of capital to throw at infrastructure projects. And I just don't get that much money from taxes. So it's around 3%. So we have to run our port like a private business almost. And it's leases and that kind of income. So if there's incentives out there, packages, Connect Oregon 1, Connect Oregon 2, great deal. Connect Oregon 3, I'm looking forward to it. We certainly need it, and we'll have our share of projects in the hopper on that one. So,
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would like to get a clarification on what an MPDS permit is.
It's you're going to ask me to for the acronym, and I can't. It's a discharge permit. So basically, and the environmental person from Port of Portland could tell you exactly what it stands for, but it's a discharge permit for process water. So
okay.
For our industry out there that uses water to cool their process, then they would actually put it back into the river. So it's just water in, water out kind of thing.
Thank you.
And when you mentioned the difficulty in finding in proceeding through that process, is it more a function of the time and the volume, or is it a function of what's involved?
I think it's a function of what's involved and clarification on what exactly the different parties want, mostly. Interpretation of the permit.
Okay. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jerry, would you tell us what role public opinion and public support plays in terms of your development activities? As you said, you're principally a real estate developer. And as I've traveled around and I've observed in some communities, economic development is an unpleasant term. You've had some very large projects with very significant capital investment and very large utilization of the public's infrastructure. How were you able to accomplish that?
Well, as I mentioned, the Port of St. Helens is pretty—it's pretty vast. It covers, again, 60 miles, so it changes from South County to North County, and I don't think you probably want to get into that. But it tends to be easier for us to do these big, large projects further north in our county. You know, it's just—it's a common fact that Scappoose and St. Helens are more bedroom communities. People, they drive into Portland to their jobs, and so I think maybe some of those communities don't see the need for economic development as much as folks in South County. So it's been a bit of a struggle, but I will say that at Port Westward, it's been a great experience. Folks have welcomed the industrial use out there. They recognize that those jobs that are created are good, high-paying, sustainable jobs. So, and I'm anxious to do some good things in South County as well.
Thank you. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jerry, ever since Representative Bailey brought up the subject of the Urban Renewal District and the Enterprise Zone overlapping, I've been trying to get my heads around how the numbers on that work. Would you be willing to give us the dollar amounts and the numbers that
are
involved?
I wish I could, but I'm not the expert on that. So what I would do is I would have our business development person get back to you on that and give you the specifics on it.
That's kind of an intriguing concept.
Sure, I understand.
Yes. Looks like you've exhausted the committee's questions for the moment. I really appreciate you coming and helping us orient ourselves. I think the role of ports is a pretty important one for us to understand as we start our conversation, and I expect we might have opportunity to ask you further questions in the future, but I know it's a trip to get here, and really glad you were able to do it and help us today. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And committee, I'd just say thanks for hanging in with us as we do some of this orientation stuff. We've got some bills in our possession. We're working through the process of getting those scheduled. So a couple more hearings to come in this orientation vein. On Thursday, we'll be hearing from the from Eco Northwest, and have a series of experts and testimonials on efforts toward lean manufacturing, how that can help small businesses in Oregon remain competitive and have some environmental benefit as well. So unless there are
other comments for the good of the order, we'll try to continue our tradition of adjourning a little bit early so we can add these up, so if we need them later on, we'll have some extra capacity, I hope. So with that, we're adjourned.